coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Clear Space Theater is a mainstay of the Rehoboth Beach arts scene, and city officials seem to want to keep it that way.
At the commissioners' meeting this past Monday, the commissioners voted to approve the majority of the terms in a proposed development agreement.
We look at plans to build a new performing arts campus for Clear Space in Rehoboth. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. History Matters looks at a historically black sorority at the University of Delaware as it turns 50 years old. Arts Playlist previews upcoming performances from Wilmington's Market Street Music. And Enlighten Me explores why fans always need to open their wallets for tickets to their favorite sporting events. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Clear Space Theater in Rehoboth Beach is looking to expand, moving from its current 170-seat theater in a former church to a much larger space with two theaters, a fully developed backstage area, and dedicated workspaces for props, costumes, and scenery. Clear Space has two options to choose from, including one in downtown Rehoboth. To find out more about their plans and the process, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny talked to Joe Fowler, Clear Space Theater's managing director.
Tell me about your plans for this potential new space.
So for the better part of the last year and a half, Clear Space has been working on a project to identify a site and identify the proper scope for a new performing arts center for Clear Space to call home and to provide the residents of coastal Sussex County the quality of experience that they deserve in a performing arts center. Sussex County is the only county in the state that lacks a purpose-built performing arts center of any kind, and all of the arts institutions that currently perform in Sussex County do so in otherwise reclaimed spaces. Clear Space's current venue on Baltimore Avenue in Rehoboth Beach is a beautiful old church sanctuary that was formerly Epworth Church before they moved to another site many years ago. But without the ability to grow beyond the confines of the space that we're currently in, recognizing the growth in our community, recognizing the demand from our community, it was clear over this last little while that some work needed to be done to assess how we could best serve that need for everyone who calls Sussex home and everyone who visits Sussex County as well.
So what kind of improvements are going to be in place in this kind of potential new space?
So the new facility, after doing a great deal of sort of research and assessment, is going to look at having a roughly 300-seat main stage theater, which is growth from our current 170-seat main stage theater, as well as a second 100-seat flexible seating black box theater. That will allow Clear Space and any other arts organizations that may wish to make use of the new center the flexibility to be able to have multiple programs occurring at the same time across two different spaces, and will allow for a kind of flexibility in programming that we are currently constrained by having only one space with a very specific configuration. In addition to those performance spaces, we'll have stronger gathering spaces for the community. There will be extensive lobby spaces to make room for that larger audience, of course. And we will have improved concessions. Ideally, improved concessions will allow for some opportunity for coffee bar, snack bar, things of that nature to be available for the public throughout the day, just in conjunction with performances. And we intend to have meeting space, proper meeting space, that can be used by members of the community as well. So the back-of-house component of the new facility would include a rehearsal hall, and that rehearsal hall would be available for meetings and other purposes when we're not in rehearsal in that space, as well as a proper scenic shop, costume shop, and prop shop, and the appropriate backstage space with respect to wing space, fly space, dressing rooms, green rooms, etc., to make sure that we're providing, a best-in-class experience for all of the artists that come to Rehoboth Beach to perform, or who already live in Rehoboth Beach and are performing here.
So where are we in this process right now?
So at this point, Clear Space, and specifically the board of Clear Space, is working to make decisions about what final site selection will be. We have two sites that are in play. One site is very much publicly known at this point. It is the site of the current Cape Henlopen Senior Center at 11 Christian Street in downtown Rehoboth. Our friends at the Cape Henlopen Senior Center were gifted land some time ago on Hebron Road and have been working to raise the balance of funds they need to break ground and to move their facility over to Hebron to provide more extensive parking, specifically ADA accessible parking for the many individuals that they serve in the region on a much larger multi-acre site. And once that move is completed, the parcel that they currently occupy will become available for the city's use. And last month, the city of Rehoboth did vote to give Clear Space right of first refusal for a lease of that land. And then at the commissioners' meeting this past Monday, the commissioners voted to approve the majority of the terms in a proposed development agreement that had been constructed between the staff of the city of Rehoboth and staff and other leadership here at Clear Space Theater. There are still a few points on that development agreement that we're working to sort of iron out the finer details on. There were some excellent suggestions that were made by commissioners during the course of the recent public hearing as to how those points could perhaps be better refined to give comfort to all parties. And so we're looking forward to seeing how those final negotiations land and to see what the final development agreement might look like there. The other parcel of land is a private sale in the municipal limits of the city of Lewis. And we are wanting to make sure we can weigh both of those offers so that the board, who has the ultimate decision on this matter, can take their vote and then move us forward towards where Clear Space will be able to be in the years to come.
At the meeting earlier this week, commissioners in Rehoboth Beach, they voted 6-1 to continue discussions and continue sort of moving forward with this public-private partnership. Are you seeing that as a good sign, as kind of reason for optimism as you're moving forward?
I would say we have strong optimism that we will be able to work with the city on agreement around this development plan so that we have a final agreement for our board to review and to consider. I will say that the leadership of the city thus far has been nothing but helpful and generous with their time and trying to sort of thread the needle to see how we might be able to best proceed together. And in fairness, there isn't a lot of land inside of the downtown district in Rehoboth Beach for a facility of the scale that we would need to build to serve our region for decades to come. So it was the city who came to us initially to ask us to consider this land that is city-owned property, which led to this now ongoing dialogue about what a public-private partnership could look like on said land in Rehoboth Beach. There are public-private partnerships of all manner surrounding performing arts centers across the country, and I think it is a very hopeful sign that our commissioners currently and the staff of the city currently seem to be as enthusiastic about finding a path. But as I've said earlier, ultimately, there are two parcels that are on the table, and while we have been prioritizing our negotiations with Rehoboth to get to final terms for this development plan, our board will ultimately still need to make a decision as to the path to move forward.
Clear Space Theater is a lot more than just shows on a stage. Can you talk about some of the benefits Clear Space provides to the communities it serves?
Absolutely. So in addition to the work that's on stage, and I would make the argument there's extraordinary benefit that comes from the community gathering that occurs when people come together to see a live performance. But take all of those intangibles aside for a moment. We also have an extensive arts institute that provides arts-based learning and education for young people starting at age 3 all the way through high school, and then additional programs that we make available here in Sussex County for retired adults as well. And with this expansion to a new performing arts center, we will physically have the space to expand those Arts Institute programs to meet the needs and the demand of the community that we're part of. It is almost comical to say this, but in our current facility, for those who have been to this to our theater, you know that we have our main stage. It is a 170-seat thrust theater. And in that room, all performances occur, all sets are built, all rehearsals happen, all Arts Institute classes are held. That's a lot of activity for one room to maintain especially recognizing that we are the most prolific producer of professional theater in the state, with the sheer volume of performances that we bring to the stage each year. One, and two, we provide the most significant volume of arts-based education outside of the school system in Sussex County. So all of that activity is being held in a very small room. Once this facility is in place, and I want to be clear, it will be years before the facility is in place. This is the beginning of our process. But once that facility is in place, the ability for us to positively impact the lives of so many more young people in our region will multiply dramatically. The other piece I'd say on the education component is there's been some really great research that's been done nationally that looks at the impact of engaging in the arts for young people. And there's all sorts of data about test scores, and there's lots of conversation as to whether you can assume correlation or causation are the same on some of those metrics. But the one metric that there is clear causation in place, it was around a study that was done at the New Victory Theater in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Arts several years ago, in which a group of middle school students were given the opportunity to engage in theatrical performances at New Victory, and another group in the same school were not. And the only difference that they were able to measure between those two groups that was consistent was that those young people who had arts-based experiences during that time frame were able to articulate a future for themselves that was not constrained by their current circumstances. It allowed young people to look beyond where they were today and envision a range of futures for themselves. And I believe firmly that if that is true for a young person, there has to be a piece of that that can be true for us adults as well. The last piece I'll mention is around economic impact. We do serve the city of Rehoboth currently in a very dramatic fashion, especially when it comes to our restaurants and our hotels. Through some very conservative math, we can show that in this current year alone, there's been roughly $1.5 million in direct economic impact to the city and the businesses within the city through our performances in our current venue. And we know that as our capacity is able to grow to welcome more audiences to the theater, we will see that economic impact multiply dramatically with the new Performing Arts Center as well.
Thanks to Clear Space Theater's Managing Director Joe Fowler and our Martin Matheny for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us, History Matters is next, with a look at a historically black sorority at the University of Delaware celebrating its 50th anniversary. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The historically black sorority Delta Sigma Theta celebrates 50 years on the University of Delaware's campus in 2025. The Mu Pi chapter welcomed its 11-member charter line in 1975 and has since seen 43 more lines cross through UD's campus. The Deltas are part of the Divine Nine, historically black Greek letter organizations that formed more than a century ago. They're all involved in community service and social justice at their core. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sits down with Charterline member Terry Byard Joyner and Delta advisor and alumnus Phyllis Joyner to talk about the Mu Pi chapter's history and its future on UD's campus and beyond.
Now, Terry, can you tell me a little bit about your involvement with the sorority?
I have been involved with the sorority since 1975. I was am a charter member of Mu Pi chapter, Delta Sigma Theta, the first African-American sorority on the campus of University of Delaware. And I am still involved in the sorority. We pretty much, when we are initiated into Delta Sigma Theta, we are making a lifetime commitment to scholarship, service, social action, and sisterhood. So you can find Deltas in graduate chapters attending meetings in their 90s.
I was actually initiated in the spring of 1971 on the campus of North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro, North Carolina. I arrived in Wilmington, Delaware in 1974 as a new bride. So I was entering a new place and also transitioning from the undergraduate chapter to the alumni chapter. I didn't have any family in Delaware, so to have the sisterhood there was phenomenal for me. And I had the opportunity as a member of Wilmington alumni to be a part of the discussion that there was a possibility that there was interest at the University of Delaware in chartering a chapter. And I was excited about that.
The Deltas are known for their commitment to community. How do you think being a public service sorority makes them stand out from other sororities on UD's campus?
All of the D9 fraternities and sororities are about community service and social action. That's ingrained in the founding of our sororities and fraternities. Delta Sigma Theta, right after its inception in 1913, participated in the Women's Suffrage March. The only African Americans in the suffrage march. And they actually had to fight to become a part of that because of segregation. So they put the Deltas in the back of the line, but we were there. So we go back pretty much to the inception of the sorority in 1913. We've always been taught that our sorority is not a social sorority. It is a service sorority.
From the very, very beginning, we have always embraced those causes that uplift. We are always advocating for opening the doors for the elderly, opening the doors for educational supports, mentoring, tutoring programs for children. We are about uplifting. We uplift. And so what we offer and what we bring together is a collective umbrella, if you will, that supports our community across the United States and abroad.
It was really important for us to do two things. When we were on campus, we had the highest GPA of any Greek organization, Black or white. And it was because scholarship is one of our cardinal principles.
And I'm curious if you can tell me a little bit about what that looked like in 1975. I know that the U.S. was seeing the close of the Vietnam War. What was the culture on campus?
We were founded, as you know, at Howard University. And at that time, pretty much, we were only on historically Black colleges and universities. So it was in this 74 time period that the need emerged that there were African-American women on predominantly white campuses who needed the support. And also some of them were legacies. Some of them were daughters of Deltas. So the interest was there. And that's how it all began.
In 1975, we were more so fighting against subtle racism. And that's how I'll put it. It wasn't overt. Well, sometimes it would be overt across the campus, but it was very subtle. Once we were initiated and we received our charter from the national organization, our next step was to get a student account. And we were using the student account of Omega Psi Phi, the first Black fraternity. We're just going to use it until we get our own student account. But that proved to be a little more difficult and challenging And I think it had some racial undertones. Specifically, we were told that we had to get the approval or the membership of the White Panhellenic Council. And they said, well, in order to recognize you as member, you have to rush with us. And we knew that white sororities and black sororities rushed entirely different. In the white sororities, the girl chooses the sorority. In the black And so fundamentally, that just wasn't going to work. And that dragged on for a couple months. And it was not until our dean of students, which happened to be a Delta, which happened to also be our advisor, her name was Agnes Green, she then went to the higher ups and she said, there's no reason why Delta Sigma Theta needs to mimic, you know, and I can't even remember what the name, but the white sororities. So in a couple weeks, they sent us a letter that they changed their constitution. They added associate members, which that's what they made us. So we weren't full members, we were associate members. And then they were allowed to approve our student account. But it was only under threat that could have racial overtones or undertones to it. Or it could just be that, you know, the wheels just didn't turn fast enough. But it should not have happened because we were initiated in October and this was April.
UD is a predominantly white institution. Can you talk a little bit about what struggles that came with to establish a historically black sorority on UD's campus?
Our struggle was culturally. There really was not a black culture there other than what was sort of birthed out of Agnes really being the one to sort of establish the Black Student Union. The students weren't prepared because, like with the Omegas, they had their pledge process. They were cue dogs. So, you know, they were barking, they're chanting, you know, they're stepping, and all of that was new. And they didn't know what to expect with Black females coming on campus. And so I think that whole cultural absence now finding its way on campus through a D9 organization was revolutionary, if you will.
What do you hope to see for the future of the MuPi chapter on UD's campus?
I hope, one, to continue the legacy, but two, I'm getting kind of choked up here because I know the challenges of the last couple of years, the COVID years.
And let's just say that the guidelines say that any organization on campus that is officially recognized has to have 10 members. Well, I think it's just a matter of proportion. See, it's not difficult when you're on a predominantly white campus for white fraternities and sororities to meet their numbers. On a predominantly white campus for a black fraternity or sorority to meet the numbers, it's more challenging. So proportionately, I think that regulation should be adjusted.
And that leads me to my last question, which is, do you have any advice for young women who are interested in becoming Deltas?
My advice always centers around knowing who you are. And so it's very, very important that people who want to be, first of all, want to serve, because that's so important within Delta Sigma Theta and within the D9 community, that we are here to serve. We are here to make our community stronger. We are here to be door openers.
Thanks to Delta Sigma Theta alums Dr. Terry Byard Joyner and Dr. Phyllis Joyner, as well as our Abigail Lee, for showing us why history matters this week. Up next, Arts Playlist and a preview of fall offerings from Wilmington's Market Street Music. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. With the seasons changing, Wilmington's Market Street Music is back in action with a series of fall performances. On this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny speaks to Market Street Music Executive Director Jordan Barrett, along with musicians from two of the ensembles performing this month, the Pixis Piano Trio's Jennifer Zijin and Hiroko Yamazaki, and Emily Ballantyne Erb, conductor of the Center City Chorale.
So let me start with you, Jordan. Tell me about Market Street Music, the mission, and what you do.
Market Street Music is a nonprofit organization. We present high-quality concerts at low or no cost in downtown Wilmington. Our mission includes both making these concerts available and accessible to the public, as well as supporting artists with really great performing opportunities. And I should say that while we're centered on classical music, I think we're unique in this area that we also branch out into areas like jazz and folk and world music.
Let me turn to the folks from the Pixis Piano Trio. And I want to ask first, this is a really interesting program that you've chosen. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about just that first half and how the and about the music that you've chosen for that.
Yeah. So since this month is a Hispanic Heritage Month, so we decided to celebrate by finishing the first half of the program with Latin and Spanish-inspired music. So the first piece on our program is Joaquin Turina's Piano Trio No. 1 in D major. Turina was one of Spain's most distinctive composers in the early 20th century. And you can definitely hear the sunshine and the passion of Spain in his music. Like many ambitious young musicians of his time, Turina went to Paris to study. So he studied with Dandy and hang out with Debussy and Ravel. He absorbed that elegant French impressionist sound. He came back home and created his wonderful blending of French color and Spanish fire. Turina Piano Trio No. 1 is one of his most beloved chamber work. After Turina, we'll play three duos for violin and cello, something a Pixis tradition. We love including violin cello duos to add variety to our programs. The three duos were arranged by the violinist and the composer Hirono Border. The first piece is Ruggiero. Ruggiero is in the Brazilian choro style. The word choro literally means a sad cry. But the music itself is usually lively, full of joy, the kind of music that just makes you want to tap your foot and smile. The second piece is Una Brava by Angel Villadu. He's often called the father of tango. He wrote some of very first tango in the early 1900s. The music really has that kind of spirit, energetic, playful, and full of personality. The last tango we'll play is El Esquinazo, which means the corner. It's another early tango by Villadu that captures the raw street flavor of tango before it became polished and elegant.
You guys are doing one of my favorite pieces of chamber music, the Schumann Piano Trio No. 3. And so let me go to you, Hiroko. Tell me a little bit about this work and also how the Schumann complements the music on the first half of the program.
Well, it's a stark contrast to the first half, you know, where we have a lot of sunnier pieces on the first half. You know, I think it's the personality of Schumann that really comes through in the second half. So he wrote three piano trios, and this is the third of them. he wrote this one closer to his death. And you can tell that his mental health issues have really gotten the best of him at this point. So, yeah, we thought it would be a nice contrast to the first half. I also wanted to keep this in the European side of things, because our second program for Market Street, which will be in April of 2026, that'll be an all-American program. So I wanted to keep this European and European-inspired program for October. We have a special guest for our April concert. Jordan Barrett will be singing, so I wanted to plug that too.
Oh, that's going to be fantastic. Let me turn to you now, Emily, and ask you about your ensemble, Center City Chorale, performing on October 30th. Tell me about this ensemble first.
So the Center City Chorale is a group of about 30 singers who come together during lunchtime on Tuesdays to rehearse, and they present four of our Thursday noontime concerts during each season. This group has been in existence for over 40 years and was started as a way for folks working in downtown Wilmington to be able to sing in an ensemble on their lunch break. Many of our members are retired from the jobs that originally brought them to Center City Chorale, but there are still many that come on their lunch break. And I'm so grateful for those that drive in from, you know, out of town to come in still as they're retired, but it just means a lot to them. There's wonderful camaraderie in the group. They work really hard. They're a wonderful bunch of people, and I'm excited to be working with them.
And I understand on this program coming up at the end of October, you're going to be doing a little bit of jazz and a little bit of Hello Autumn kind of stuff as well.
Yes, we have five pieces on the program, and they all celebrate the autumn season in some way. We are opening with a piece called For the Autumn Sky, which really talks about the beauty of the leaves changing and falling and the wind blowing through the trees. It's a really wonderful celebratory start to the program. And then we also have a Paul Langford arrangement of two Johnny Mercer songs, Autumn Leaves and When October Goes. And that arrangement has some really cool, tight jazz harmonies that I think is challenging for the group, but they are rising to the occasion. It's coming together really well, and I'm excited to hear what it sounds like at the end of the month. We also have a piece by Norwegian composer Oleg Yalo called Seasons, which again talks about all four seasons, but really sort of has a melancholy autumnal feel to it that fits the program really well. We have a piece by Audrey Snyder called Autumn Vesper, and the text to that is taken from an Emily Bronte poem called Written in Aspen Castle. And she actually started this poem while traveling in Belgium and didn't finish it for a few months. But the text is sort of a rearrangement of her poem through the words. It's really beautiful. Sort of talks about the haunted aspect of fall. And, you know, this concert is on October 30th, so it's the day before Halloween, so we have a little bit of a nod to the spookiness of the season. And then we end the program with John Rutter's For the Beauty of the Earth, which has been a favorite of mine since I was a child. And I just can't think of the fall season without thinking of this song. And it, on the way out of rehearsal just on yesterday, one of our singers told me that the song has such joy inherent in it, and you just can't help but express that when you're singing it. So I hope the audiences feel that as well.
Yeah, and for people listening, if you haven't heard the choral music of John Rutter, you're in for a treat. He's one of the best kind of contemporary choral composers, I think, right now.
Yes.
And has been for quite some time.
Yes. I think an interesting thing about this program, this is coincidental but worth noting, all of the composers and arrangers, with the exception of Johnny Mercer, are living, which is kind of cool, a whole program of living composers. And we will be featuring two instrumentalists. We have a flutist coming to join us, and one of our own singers, a cellist, will be playing on the Mercer mashup as well.
Excellent. Let me come back to you, Jordan, to sort of wrap our discussion up. We've mentioned this a couple of times, and Center City Chorale, that concert is kind of a non-traditional concert time, 12:30 in the afternoon on a Thursday. And there are some other of these Thursday lunchtime concerts that you've mentioned. I know Philadelphia Viola Quartet is coming up on the 16th. James Fernando Jazz Trio on the 23rd, just in this month. Can you talk for a moment about what makes these lunchtime performances special and important to the work that you do?
Well, first and foremost is the fact that they are completely free to the public. They are just 30 minutes, and so they're really designed for if you have a lunch break working in downtown Wilmington that you can just pop in. We collect a free will offering, but it's not necessary, so that, you know, in the fall and in the spring, you can get 10 weeks each of just these little snippets of something beautiful to just kind of break up your day. And I know that more and more workers are coming back to downtown Wilmington. Companies are moving into Wilmington. They're building apartments. So, you know, we hope that more and more people are going to be able to enjoy these totally free of charge, just half an hour. I think that little digestible snippet is what makes them special. And it's such a big variety, from jazz to world music to choral music to organ music, etc.
And a good way to spend your lunch hour, probably more productive than doom scrolling on your phone, right?
I agree. This is really the opposite of doom scrolling. It's just sitting somewhere without thinking too much and absorbing something beautiful.
Thanks to Market Street Music Executive Director Jordan Barrett for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist, along with Jennifer Zijin and Hiroko Yamazaki from the Pixis Piano Trio, and Emily Ballantyne Erb from the Center City Chorale. The Pixis Piano Trio performs October 18th, and Center City Chorale performs October 30th. For more information, head to marketstreetmusicde.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn why tickets to your favorite sporting events remain stubbornly expensive. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The current economy has plenty of people concerned and complaining about the cost of groceries, gas, and other necessities, looking for ways to cut back and save. But what about ticket prices to attend a professional sporting event in the Philadelphia area? The price of attending sporting events never seems to get the same scrutiny, despite increases year over year. As a matter of fact, the demand for Philly's playoff tickets or to see the defending Super Bowl champion Eagles is higher than ever, even as people pay more to fuel up to get to the game or stock up the tailgate prior to it. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari speaks with Matt Robinson, professor of sports management at the University of Delaware, to discuss how prices for sporting events seem to be immune from what's going on outside of the stadium or arena.
Matt, we know fans in the area, they would have loved to have been at Citizens Bank Park for a Phillies playoff game, despite the results of those first two games, or even the opening Eagles-Cowboys game at the Link. But yeah, Tickets are just so expensive for many, even with the economy the way it is and the economy down. Why does that happen?
Yeah, when you talk about a ticket, it's really about scarcity and demand. So one, if there's a demand, it's kind of driven by scarcity. So I think with the case of the baseball, the Phillies pay, you know, Major League Baseball teams, you know, play, 172 games, you know, over the course of the year. But there's only a limited amount of baseball games being played right now, and one of them happened to be in Philadelphia. So that scarcity of games and the significance of it, you know, is going to drive up that price on the secondary market. So I think what's always been interesting is that the rise of that secondary market is going to be dictated by that demand. There's people that literally, you know, there's entities out there that have those tickets, and, you know, they'll raise that price, and if somebody's willing to pay it, they'll take it. So I think when you look at the Phillies, you know, even more so maybe, you know, this is their third year, you know, that they've been in, especially that first year when they, you know, hey, this was, the Phillies back in the playoffs, I think it was almost 8 years. There was incredible excitement around it. And so if people are willing to pay, you know, the market, you know, the price is going to be there. If they're not, then that price would decline. And the same thing with the NFL. You always talk about the NFL. There's, you know, there's only 8 professional football games. You know, or I'm sorry. Well, no, that's 12. What they play 14. So, seven professional football games in Philadelphia over the course of a year, and that which what really drives that price of that ticket. So again, it doesn't surprise me, you know, in that scarcity, that interest around it. It's a lot different than a game being played midweek in, you know, in April against the American League Central team that the whole season hasn't played out. So that ticket may not be priced the same as these tickets now.
You mentioned the secondary market and the role it plays here. Does it go even further? Because one, it's competition for the teams, but it's also, if you know someone's willing to pay that much to see a game in some cases, why don't the teams just figure, why don't we just put the price up out there so we can get the full financial benefit? Is that both those things go into it also?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, like you said, when you talk about what the team is going to charge, they can't control that, you know, and again, I think that's partly where that secondary markets come in. I mean, the old days was the scalper. That's, you know, illegal. The secondary is there. But I always think that just in general, let's not even talk about the secondary market, but let's talk the cost that's associated with professional sports these days and major college athletics, even as that continues to expand in and around the NIL and the payment of these players, the cost associated with organizations being able to break even in some cases. So what does that cost? So you see it's not just the ticket price, but also the total cost of the fan experience. So let's talk parking. And, you know, I know that the Sport Business Journal, it's kind of the Wall Street Journal of sport, always kind of runs a number to say, okay, yes, ticket, but let's talk about a family of four, you know, two sodas, two beers, four hot dogs, parking, you know, and, you know, maybe a licensed product, what that total cost is for that evening, exceeds that price. But teams are dependent upon that revenue stream as far as their revenue generation. So I know that the NFL has a revenue stream, significant revenue stream in and around their broadcast, their national broadcast deal, but still the cost of admission is significant when they have salaries to pay and they want to remain competitive. And I think it's even more so when you talk baseball, that they always talk about large market, small market teams, that in New York has a larger local media contract than a smaller market team, like a Milwaukee, you know, or a Minnesota. And so that, again, when you start talking about ticketing prices and how significant they are, you know, that's factored in.
There's also so much competition amongst the secondary market. There's the different websites, even Ticketmaster gets involved. I think in some cases, some certain teams also have their own little secondary market deal going on. So that has to get into it too, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and like you said, look, you know, I find it interesting when you'll see tickets and, you know, it's equivalent to buying stock. I mean, you'll see a ticket that's hot and then injury, whatever, all of a sudden you'll see that price drop. And I think you even see it on the secondary market. There's the one site that's out there that it's like the last minute tickets that, again, I had it at a set price. I didn't get anybody, but 5 minutes before, you know, hey, nobody's bought it. Hey, I'm just looking to break even on this thing instead of eating the ticket. And there's that market too. So, yeah, I find it fascinating just the way that's evolved. And like you had said, the future of it, I don't know. But like you had said, the days of the teams, and you made a great point, the teams put the ticket out there and then the scalper buying it and doing it illegally, you know, increasing the prices. But now that the secondary market is recognized and it's a part of it. I mean, even if you call, I know I've done this, you know, when you call a team about tickets, you know, they'll say it's sold out, but go to the secondary market. There's tons of seats there. You know, that we don't have any more tickets, but the secondary market has them.
See, with concerts, a lot of people were complaining when Bruce Springsteen came to Philly the last couple of years, and his ticket prices were higher. And the excuse was, hey, if on the secondary market they're going to sell for $1,000, we're going to put it out $1,000 here for these floor seats, and people were complaining. But that's just part of the business now, right?
Well, I think the music industry, and I don't, you know, but you know, it's interesting there where they talk about how the business model of music has flipped. It used to be you made your money off your albums, and then you went out and did a tour to promote the albums, get people to buy more albums. But now when you start talking about the downloads and what musicians aren't making off of Spotify and so forth, that now that the concerts are the revenue generators for them. And so, like you said, I mean, I saw an interview with Springsteen just talking about that he always was like, hey, I kept my ticket prices reasonable, but just seeing what other people were charging because they had to, you know, try to make it, you know, to make money off of it. He goes, hey, you know, why shouldn't I, you know, kind of thing, you know, with it. But he, like, in his mind, he's still trying to keep it lower than what some others were charging, but understanding that that's the new model of the music industry, you know, with things. And I think it's really interesting with professional sport that now, if you think about it, it's almost all moving to pay, whether it be the streaming, whether it be cable, the idea of anything free as far as sport is concerned. I know that, you know, again, the broadcast on a Comcast, again, is that cable, you're paying for that. It's kind of interesting. But again, I think at the end of the day, it's about the cost of doing business in professional sport, and it's significant. And it's already occurring in college athletics. Now that you're looking at the top tier programs, you have to pay for that talent in order to remain at that top tier. And that gets passed on to the fan.
Also, is it for the professional teams, it's just so much easier to advertise nowadays because with social media, with email, they can reach the fans on a more personal level with the same message that they put on billboards or on commercials during the games. Like, I can't tell you how many emails I get a week. You know, they're not even specials or deals about buying tickets, going to the next game, the next homestand, whatever. Does that easy advertising for them play a part where people, all right, the economy's bad, but hey, I got this email. I'm gonna go to the game. I'm going to go to the Phillies game tonight, or I'm going to the Eagles game Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, the level of that they're using data analytics to reach you in a very specific personal way, you know, it's very high level, their marketing efforts now that's being done. And just like you had said, that whole idea that the information that we end up putting into the internet and how it's used to help target you with the right message about the right price on the right date at the right opponent, down to you saying this is an easy decision. Yes, you take a look at the size of marketing departments within the professional sport organizations, it's very strategic in the way they're reaching out to their customer base. I think the other thing, too, with that, of the old day of pro sport, they used to say you were taking orders. You know, you sat back, you had a good team, you sat back, you took orders, meaning, hey, we're good this year, we're going to sell a lot of tickets. We're not, guess what, we're not. You know, we're not going to sell. But organizations can't be that way. You look at the 76ers during the process when they were, you know, arguably the worst franchise in the NBA on the court, they were actually doing very well with attendance, and it had a lot to do with their progressive marketing efforts of reaching out to people and communicating that, whether it be selling the entertainment value of the experience, putting together pricing and or packages that made it appealing to get people to come out to those events. So I think the old day of sport marketing was, we got a good team, we're going to sell out. We got a bad team, well, we got, you know, we're going to have to live with it. No, I think they're very strategic, what you had said there, that they will communicate with you to make it that it's an easy buy for you, that you want to do it.
Also, when the economy is going better, do the increases get higher, or is it just business as usual, whether the economy is good or bad? But of course, if they do get higher, usually with prices, what goes up doesn't necessarily come down, right?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing about sport, I think sport in general is, I'm not going to say recession-proof, but even back to 2008, look, people were taking the hit, so they maybe didn't buy four season tickets. Maybe they bought two, or maybe they bought a mini plan. So sport is that thing that it's part of our culture that we make time. There's people that are buying their season tickets before they pay the utility bill, that the passion is so strong. Other products would kill to have the passion that sport fans have for their teams. You want to look at it from a straight marketing sense, it's a product, and there's incredible brand loyalty to a product that in many cases may not, I'm not going to stop completely. I may reduce my spending until things level out or get better, that I can go back to my usual consumption level. So the economy, you know, it does impact some aspects of it, but I don't think, like I said, I think sport is one of those things that it survives through recessions, you know, just because of that passion and interest.
In the end, it's just, we just love sports so much that we just don't care, right?
And, you know, remember, you know, sport is selling. I remember talking to somebody about this back, like with the Phillies, I remember it was the series with the Padres. They were talking about the pricing, and I said, look, I don't think many people were complaining when they walked out of that stadium when Harper hit that home run. They had been a part of history. They had been a part of an event. It's one of those games that, what the, you know, they hold 40-some thousands in Citizens Bank, but 5 years from now, there's probably a good 200,000 that were there, according to that, you know, according to themselves. And again, when we start getting to playoffs, these are becoming iconic moments in the city's history. And to say that you were there, you have that experience, and you walk out after that game, I don't think you're thinking twice about how much you spent on that ticket, you know, in that sense. So I think that's the one thing that's unique about sport.
Thanks to University of Delaware Professor of Sports Management Matt Robinson and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And we've hit the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.